My name is Corey. I'm an alcoholic.
Corey.
And I'm sweating. You know, for somebody that I thought this morning, Damon says it a lot in the big book. It talks about noisy good fellows craving attention. And that would be me. But you know, like a lot of things in my life, what I supposedly wanted or longed for, as soon as I got, I didn't want it. So I wanted attention, look at me, and as soon as you were looking at me, what the hell are you looking at? I wanted somebody to love me. As soon as they tried, I pushed them away. And when I came in here begging for help, you tried to help me, and I wouldn't let you. I said, I'm good. You know, I've done that recently. I've asked for help, come in a meeting and said I was struggling, and had people reach out. Maybe we could get together and do this. And I'm like, no, I'm good. You know, that self-sufficiency has cost me a lot. And that little disclaimer is that my story involves a lot of jail, a lot of institutions, a lot of loss. And that is not necessary to be an alcoholic. You know, I've come to understand that we all get here in different ways or whatever, but the end result and where we end up is typically the same. The emotions are the same. The bottoms are pretty similar. It doesn't matter the circumstance. I was born in Upper Michigan, a little town called Escanaba, about 40,000 people on Lake Michigan. At three, I moved to a much smaller town of about 3,500 people on Lake Superior, and pretty much ran wild. You know, everybody says it today, all these kids today, all they do is look at their electronics. Well, I mean, my parents, and I understand why, but they just, you know, when the sun, you eat breakfast and you're gone. And you come back for dinner, if you don't come back with somebody for lunch. But beautiful country. I mean, Upper Michigan is just gorgeous, and there was so much as a kid to explore and do in the woods. And I mean, we had a cedar forest, and we were on about 10 acres of land behind a golf course, and had a cedar forest back in there, and these huge, massive trees. I mean, we spent one summer, a group of us, cutting down one tree, taking turns with an axe, all summer long. And when that tree fell, it was felt like in a 10-mile radius all around. Huge tree. Rappelling down waterfalls at, you know, 6 years. I don't know how we survived. But, you know, as I was thinking about this, there's some things that stuck out. And one was my first day in kindergarten. Or I don't know if it was the first day, but it was right there. But they had the immunizations. I was the last of the years to get the big circle on the arm immunization. Well, my name's Curtis, so I was I was one of the first ones to go back for this shot, and I resisted it, and it took like six people to hold me down. I'm screaming bloody murder, kicking teachers, punching, thrashing, fighting. You're not going to do this shit to me. It's not right. This is my first, and I remember coming out of that room, and tears in my eyes, and they give you a freaking lollipop, and I came out, and that expression on that class, the terror in their eyes. What are they doing back there? You know, but that nature, that resistance, that defiance, that you know, I just gave the teachers pure hell, and I was a mischievous, destructive, thieving little kid. If you went to look in your lunchbox and your Twinkie was gone, that was me. I would do stuff like that. I would vandalize the school, and then, you know, but I developed a good face and a good ability to lie early. Nobody would ever suspect me. I could put off like this nice kid, you know what I mean? And I don't know. But anyway, so child psychiatrist got involved in probably second grade, and this was a pattern through my life. You know, fourth grade I saw one, was diagnosed with, I don't even know what they called it back then, gave me an IQ test, and that was This started a whole thing in my mind, a grandiosity, because my IQ test was like very high. And so then it became, well, he knows what he's doing. He's doing this shit on purpose, you know. Right. He's smart. He knows better. And I don't know. You know, the predominant things that I got from my childhood and really all through my life was, what the hell is wrong with you? Everybody was asking me, what the hell is wrong with you? My parents, my teachers, girlfriends. To this day, Karen says, what the hell is wrong with you? You know, so the diagnosis started early, you know, fourth grade or whatever. And my first visit to the police station was at 9 years old. And it was in Upper Michigan. It snowed. I mean, we used to make tunnels through the snowbanks and run through them because the snow was that high. I mean, it was just. So there was people that went to Florida for vacation. Well, me and a couple friends, I don't remember if it was my idea or not, but there's a good chance it was, decided to break into this house to climb up on the roof to jump into the snow after a blizzard had, you know, that seemed like a fun thing to do. Well, once we broke in and it got spread through other people were going in there and TVs got took, and I mean, the whole house got rampaged. All we were doing is going up and jumping off the roof. That was my intention. That's all I did. But, so 9 years old, my dad, I remember sitting in the kitchen and my dad answered the phone and, yes, this is Mr. Curtis. Yes, that's my son. And I was, oh, shit. I just remember that I knew it was coming. Well, they put me in handcuffs. They scared the shit out of me at the police station. They put me in handcuffs. And, you know, I just babbled and cried and swore that this is all that I did. And I don't know who did that, but I didn't do that. And whatever. And got out of that one. But that was kind of a foreshadowing of what was to come in my life. You know, I realized in sobriety that you know, in trying to escape a lot of my past and drink away my memories, I didn't just suppress the bad ones. I suppressed all the good ones, too. So probably at about 3 years sober, I began to remember some of the better stuff of my life. You know what I mean? Still not a whole lot comparatively, but it was good there. But the other things when I was thinking about this stood out was probably 7, 8, 9, somewhere around there, my grandmother thought it was a good idea to let me watch The Exorcist. And at that age, that movie was so freaking terrifying. I prayed every day for years that God would not let me get possessed. I probably should have kept praying that prayer because my alcoholism and the way it reacted on me, the personality change was so dramatic that it was like possession at times. I remember coming out of a blackout in Buckhead, screaming, coming like looking at myself from outside of myself, and I'm screaming, "Support the IRA!" Like some crazed Irishman. And I'm like, I don't even know what the frickin' IRA is. I had to go research after what. And I was like, what is that? Where was that? Where did that come from? Where in the hell would that come from? That I was screaming to all the people in Buckhead to support the IRA. Insanity. I don't know. But the blackouts were scary. And there was a lot of. I get ahead of myself. I said to somebody before this meeting, it's probably going to be like a Scorsese movie because I'm going to be all over time, period. No planning, no notes. So anyway, you know, in those years in elementary or whatever, I thrived. You know, I had the ability to like fit in with the cool kids, the athletes, the popular kids, but I preferred the weirdos. I just did. They were more interesting. It seemed like the cool kids talked about everybody else. The weird kids or the nerdy kids talked about shit that was interesting. You know what I mean? They were so I was naturally drawn to more of the outcast type. Like I said, even though I could fit in, and I remember turning on one of those friends when I was with the other group, with the popular group, and I turned on him, and boy, that hurt me. I just always remember that. You know, I looked at his, I saw his eyes, and I realized, you know, I had hurt him. I joined them, and I, you know, making fun of him, and it hit me hard. So, like I said, these are a lot of random memories coming here, but you know, I thrived. I was good. I ran like the wind. I was in track. I was the anchor. I was the guy that was always up front, 150s, and just could move. And you think I would have got arrested less because of that, but it didn't always work out. You know, like I said, it's basically the same. Just a lot of trouble through those elementary years. A lot of mischief, a lot of, vandalism, that type of thing. But then in 13, we moved to Marietta. And I was in eighth grade, and eighth grade at that time was at Lassiter High School. So I moved from a town of 3,500 to a school of 3,500. And the culture shock was absolutely overwhelming. Up in Michigan, the people like I was that grew up, they called them woodsies. It would be the equivalent of redneck down here, just kind of, you know. And I was thrust into this suburban. You know, I thought members only. You actually had to be a member to have the jacket. I didn't have a clue. I'm getting, you know, my mom's dressing me in Kmart shit, and I, you know, the whole culture thing was, and I was overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed. You know, the other thing from my childhood that I would say, aside from the outstanding defiance and rebelliousness and all that, was sensitivity. And I think some of the acting out was because of my sensitivity, because I just, God, I felt so deeply, and I did not like that. You know what I mean? When I had a feeling for a girl, it was like I didn't like the out-of-control feeling, and I would push away or be mean or to go in front of people, to be in a situation where I had to walk across a group of people. The anxiety was just overwhelming. And I was emotional, you know, and I think a lot of my trying to formulate who I was trying to push that down, my nature, that sensitive nature that I had, you know, trying to be a tough guy. And so we moved down here, and I mean, I immediately gravitated towards the black clothes people, the heads, the druggies, the whatever. They seemed to be real accepting if you had some drugs, you know what I mean? If you had a little bit of... got a little bit of weed, and these people are like, come on, hang out with us. Pretty easy to fit in. Didn't seem as judgmental, and I dove in. I mean, by the time I was 14, so a year after we'd moved here, I was pretty much grabbing anything I could and doing illegal shit to get it. You know, they prescribed me with pills because of my ADD or whatever, and they didn't do anything for me because... you know, they're amphetamine to everybody else, but to me they didn't have an effect. And people love these things, so I could sell those. And then I was selling other drugs, and I immediately gravitated towards older people. And but by 14, I probably had my first. Well, I got to back up again. My first drink was probably in that 7, 8, 9 range. I don't know for sure, but I had probably had a few sips of beer. The first time I felt alcohol, the first time I drank enough to feel it, was I was probably around 8 or 9. And my parents, this is back in the 70s or whatever, and so me and my cousin were outside, and they are just laughing like hyenas. I mean, we're like, what are they doing? And they're just dying laughing. They were smoking weed and drinking tequila, you know. So we went in there, and we're sitting, and we're looking. They're still laughing and just acting fools, and my cousin says... can I have a sip of that? And he points to the tequila bottle on the table. And you know, my aunt's like, oh, let him have a sip. He'll never want to drink again. And my mom's like, you can't let a kid drink tequila, you know. My mom's very prudish and tight, very Catholic and regimented. Anyway, she was smoking weed's kind of incredible. But so my cousin took a sip of the tequila, and he runs to the sink and he spits it out. I took a good sip. I mean, I took a good gulp, and boy, that when it hit my stomach, and it just moved everywhere, and I felt it, you know, just like an explosion, and was just fascinated immediately. Wow. I mean, just wow. So anyway, my aunt says he didn't drink any. You know, she thought that I had fake drink because I didn't really make much of a face. I mean, I just experienced it. And so she said he didn't drink any, and I got pissed off. She's making fun of saying I didn't drink, so I took a big gulp and I gargled the tequila. Well, they all bust out laughing, dying, you know, that this kid gargling tequila. Well, so I laugh and it shoots through my nose. And but anyway, here's the thing that was unique about it, and this I've come to find out that this is kind of a something that can be characterized of alcoholism. Is an unusual first response to alcohol. Well, I broke out in like a rash. I had these huge blotches on my arm, on my neck, on my face. And my aunt again said, well, you'll always know when he's drinking. You know, but that unusual response was there for the beginning. And then there was a couple other times. I think one time they, some family gathering, they had Kool-Aid in one pitcher and wine in the other. And we inadvertently got the wine pitcher. And the other kids are like, this is the wrong thing. And I'm like, shut up. It's okay. And I remember going to bed on that one and getting the full bed spin. I mean, just a full spin effect, you know. And then getting sick and red wine on the carpet. Yeah, that was nice. But when I, you know, when I was down, when we moved down here, it was pretty quick that I got into, you know, some of the drugs first. And then got some alcohol. You know, there's a group of us, maybe five of us. And we got a hold of a case of beer, I think. And, most of them drank like a couple beers and were like, whoa. And, you know, and me and this guy, Chris Wyatt, drank the rest. And I don't know, 9 beers apiece maybe or something like that. But for the first time, it got me pretty good. And he turned out to be a cocaine addict in recovery. And I turned out to be what I turned out to be, which is here. So from that first experience, it just escalated fast. I was seeking just, you know, to get high, to get loaded, any chance I could, any way I could. I any drug I could get a hold of, any way to come up with enough money to get alcohol. So at 14, I had saved up enough money with a friend, and we decided we're going to steal a car and go to Florida. 14 years old. I can't even imagine. My kids are that age, and I just can't even imagine. But I did. We did, you know. We stole a Silverado from a construction site, headed to Florida. And Macon, he decided that the truck wasn't cool enough to cruise around on the strip down in Florida, so we needed a sharper car. So he stopped to steal another car. He got caught. I ran. I ended up coming back to Georgia. And that was my first big, it was auto theft. By the time I was 18, I had 3 of those. And, I was put in rehab at, I think I was 14, late 14, and long-term rehab. Got out of there, and 16 had my first DUI, which almost killed myself and a friend of mine. He went through the windshield completely and went home, and I went through the windshield, got hung up. I had a .28 blood alcohol. The doctor told me. He said, I know you're not supposed to say somebody's an alcoholic, but I can tell you right now you're going to have problems, kid, because nobody should be talking to me with your blood alcohol level. Got another DUI at 17, another one at 18, mixed in with other criminal stuff. I was really protected in a lot of ways. For the crimes that I've been convicted of, which are only a fraction of what I was, what I did, I always seem to get out of it somehow, or be protected in the situation. When I was 17, I did go down to Florida, and I ended up, this was in the height of the crack epidemic, and I got hooked bad. I ended up, down there for several months. I think it was close to 7 months at 17, and smoking that stuff, eating, you know, all I remember is crack, gin, and sardines. I was going in neighborhoods where other white guys really weren't, but I was with a guy and his wife that I had met, and we were shoplifting, professional shoplifting for a living. So we'd go steal meat and sell it to people, rip people off, tourists off from the beach. We had all kinds of scams to support the habit. So when I got locked up, I was 6 foot tall, 128 pounds. I used to have hair, and I used to have really dense hair. So when my hair grew out, it looked like an afro. So I had an afro and a beard at 17. And they locked me up for aggravated assault because I was caught shoplifting, and I took out a knife and was swinging it on people, and that's aggravated assault. So pretty heavy sentence. You get put with the murderers when you got that charge. Anyway, so when I get put in the jail, there was 2 other white guys in that cell block, and I watched them get beat, get their food stolen. I mean, just terrorized. But when I walked into that block, the bull of the block was a guy named Sean. I forget his street name, but... he came up to me and he gave me the handshake and the half hug, and nobody messed with me because he was like the boss protected. And then the charges ended up getting dropped because when I first gotten arrested, they had put me in an adult jail because they didn't believe that I was 17 because, I mean, my eyes were sunk in. I was an absolute mess, and they had put me in adult jail temporarily, and that violated juvenile rights or something. And anyway, they dropped the charges, said never come back to Broward County, and came back. There's just a lot of times like that where I should have been in a lot worse consequences than I got. At 18, when I got my third auto theft, the state was asking for 10 years to serve 8. My parents were friends with a guy who was high up in Cobb County management. He got Jimmy Berry, who was one of the top lawyers in Cobb County. The guy was a $100,000 guy for a case. Everybody has to serve their public defender. He got put in public defender, so he defended me. Got that 10-8 reduced down to, I think I did 7 months in the county work camp. Stuff like this the whole time. All these, it was almost every time that I got in trouble, the bigger things, that I was protected or I got out way lighter. And But I started a cycle. You know, that criminal stuff really probably stopped after that third, after that third auto theft. I quit stealing. And it actually became, I like overcompensated to where I won't take a freaking bubble gum. Yeah, I wouldn't take 2 cents worth of something without paying for it. I can't think of the word right now. It's something that I prided myself on, was honesty and paying for, you know, and not taking, not stealing or whatever. So that shifted. But then I spent more time straight because of alcohol. You know, the drunken, disorder, a lot of fighting. A lot of fighting with the police. So I got a lot of battery charges on police. Aggravated battery was one of them, which was a 10-year sentence. Again, it was a lady in the program that had just left the DA's office, went into private practice, that took my case. That's the only reason. It was a mandatory 10-year sentence, and I was guilty as hell. There's no way around it. She got me out of it because she was just DA for 10 years, and that's the only reason. And she was in the program. So she's a judge now in Cobb County, but... Anyway, in between all these exploits and drunken craziness and arrests or whatever, my typical pattern was go to jail, get out, come to AA, stay sober a while, start drinking and using, back to jail, get out, AA, start drinking and using. Back. This cycle went on for all my 20s and probably close to into my 30s. And all told, I did over 10 years behind bars. And, you know, Adam's not here this morning that I see, but he gets it. You know, time to somebody who's gotten a used to doing time is not the same as these people that freak out because they got to go do 48 hours. It's hilarious to me when you guys freak out over that. I'm like, I mean, come on, really? Anyway, but it's all relative, you know. So I learned how to do that time. I learned how to take the consequences. I always laughed it off. And you know, the AA groups used to have little parties. Corey's getting out of jail party, and everybody get together and all that. Because I did develop some acquaintances and friends through AA, because I was out. I had been coming in and out. You know, never worked a step, never got a sponsor, but enjoyed the fellowship. And as kids, I had a pretty good group that would go out together and do things. But you know, eventually, the discomfort of being sober, the discomfort of being dry, and not working a program, and not having any kind of way to deal with the emotion. I'd end up drinking again, and then I'd suffer the consequences again. And, you know, I laughed it off, and I made light of it. I acted like that shit didn't bother me, no big damn deal. But, boy, there was many times where, I mean, the pain was pretty intense, you know, getting locked up over and over again. It took its toll. So I think as I got probably in my, well, when I hit 26, I had pretty much jumped from job to job to job. I mean, I could get a job pretty easy because I could talk fairly well. I would get a job, I'd be put in a position of leadership pretty quick, and I'd be asked an assistant manager or something along that lines, and then I'd show up drunk and destroy the opportunity. At 26, when I got out of prison, the one prison sentence was a couple years, and I got a job doing tile with the biggest asshole I've ever worked for in my life, and he taught me a lot. I think I quit like 5 times and finally walked away. He said, if you don't like the way I do it, start your own damn business. And I was like, well, shit, that's a good idea. And so I worked with him for a while longer, but every check that I got was bought. I bought tools, and I started buying what I needed to do my own. And I went out on my own about 28, and I've been doing that ever since. In between, so the jail sentence is kind of lightened down, but I think it was 28 was when I got that charge of aggravated battery on a police officer. I was looking at 10 years. Got sober, and then I had met a girl who ended up being the mother of my children, heroin addict, ex-stripper, danced all over the country, and just a wild spirit at the time. And we were like the AA couple, you know. We were coming in, and she would wear the most outrageous shit you'd ever seen in your life. I mean, when she met my parents, I think she had on leather pants and pumps, you know, and it's like... great impression on my Catholic mother. My mom was like, oh my God, what are you doing, son? So, you know, that relationship, we got together, sober for a while. She thought I had more sobriety than I did. We went back out, and that was my introduction to narcotics. And I thought I was cured of alcoholism. Because when you've got enough narcotics in you, you really don't want alcohol. You want water. You want ice water is what you crave. And it's really good. But I did. I thought I was cured of my alcoholism. Now, it was taking me like hundreds and hundreds of dollars a day to stay cured of alcoholism. But, my drug dealer absolutely loved us. He used to run into everybody else in and out, but he would let us just stay as long as we wanted because we were bringing, I didn't know the prices. I was just giving the guy, whatever. Anyway. But I found out the downside of narcotics is when you run out of narcotics, and holy shit, the withdrawal from narcotics is just absolutely brutal. And some of y'all know that. I mean, it was just horrifying. And so that cure was kind of scratched off. Well, I ran out of money, and alcohol is a lot cheaper, so I went back to alcohol. And that relationship, so as I was coming into facing this sentence this time, and like I said, Marcia got me off, so I didn't have to face what I thought I had to face, but I had to face about 7 months. And I got sober a couple weeks before with Carrie, and stayed sober 7 months. I had lost my license because of that, because there was a DUI involved and driving with the aggravated battery. And so I got out and I stayed sober. She had stayed sober, so she had been sober when we met for about 15 months. Went out with me for a summer narcotic experiment. And then she had gotten sober again 2 weeks before I got locked up. I did about 7.5 months. I got out and I did stay sober. Now, I couldn't drive, so my dad, who had retired, was working with me and basically picking me up every day and taking me to work to do this business. The business ended up growing to where I had about 7 guys working for me and was making a good amount of money. I made it about a little over 3 years, and didn't do this thing, though. I was kind of like, I had bodyguards. So I had Carrie at home watching out for me. I had my dad taking me to work. There wasn't a whole lot of time to, and I was going to meetings, and I enjoyed the meetings, and you can ride on meetings for a minute. I mean, it works. People do it, but inevitably I picked up a drink again. Now, in that course of that relationship, people love this part. So, Karen's laughing already. So, as we got sober, my first child was born probably at maybe a year, pretty quick. As soon as I got out of prison, Carrie got pregnant and we had a kid. So whatever that is, 10 months into that, I don't know. Anyway, so I had my first kid, and boy, that changed a lot too. That was probably another big reason that period of sobriety, that I was able to stay away, the responsibility of having a child or whatever. Well, after my first child, Carrie, ex-stripper now, remember all that, decides that she is a man. And I was like, what are you talking about? So the only indication I'd ever gotten of this was that when we first got together, like right as we were about to commence the first act, she says, I've always had this fantasy about being a man. Well, at that time, I didn't give a shit what she said. She could have said, I'm going to kill you as soon as this is over. Okay, whatever, just let's. It did. So that's the only indication. It's the only thing I ever heard until this came up. And then the internet and this connection or whatever. And, and it started getting more. And then, I was just like, you're fucking nuts. What are you talking about? This was way before as cool as it is today. Today it's like, people celebrate. Oh, yay. 5-year-olds think they're awesome, and give them some injections. It wasn't like that back then. It was very, it was just unheard of. And I'd sure never heard of it. I just couldn't even comprehend it. So what do you do? I got a kid. I've committed to stay with Carrie because we got a kid. Now Carrie wants to be a man. Now comes the second kid. So this is a progression of her changing, transforming, moving towards whatever. I'm a mess, man. I'm just like, I'm torn between my kids. There wasn't kids involved, obviously. But I got kids. And so this progresses, and it becomes just a big freaking issue. All of a sudden my clothes are missing, the makeup's gone, and I'm just like, what the? So, eventually I couldn't take it anymore, and I picked up a drink. I had 2 kids under 2 years old, a wife that wanted to be a man, and I was working 80 hours a week. Too much. And I picked up a drink again. And suffered, suffered pretty bad. Lost my kids. She took off. She, by the way, now is a short man with a pot belly, a goatee, and bald. So it's wild. And I, you know, I haven't necessarily, I don't know what to think about it, but it doesn't matter. I respect him, is what I call. It's hard because I don't want to say him in a meeting. I've done this before. I've been outside and said my ex and referred to him, and they're like, what? And because evidently I don't portray that I'm gay, but then I have to give the whole story and whatever. You know, it's a unique situation. But today, I can tell you, there was a time in all this that I really had such a resentment. I mean, just such a resentment. And, you know, today I have, we talk, and I am grateful for the fact that my kids were at least taken care of when I was out there drinking, you know, for their first 5 years of their life. I don't have to make a judgment on whether it's real, whether it's a mental illness. What doesn't matter? Just treat somebody the way you're supposed to treat somebody. I don't have to form an opinion. I don't have to push that on anybody. You know what I mean? Whatever. It is what it is. It doesn't really have much to do with me at this point. You know what I mean? And my kids have adapted. Because it's become so socially acceptable, my kids are not struggling from this. People are like, your dad, your mom turned into dad? That's cool. You know, that, I don't know. When I was a kid, I don't think that would have been the reaction. But today, it's become much more open, whatever. So, you know, that's a big deal to come to a point of forgiveness, to come to a point of realize it wasn't about me. She didn't do this to me. This is her stuff. You know what I mean? And sobriety brought that. And I just can't live in the judgment or whatever of that. So that was a big part of my sobriety and part of my healing. I said I wasn't going to talk about the past the whole damn time, and here I go. Anyway, so for the next, those years after my kids left, it was so dark. It was so freaking dark. I had nobody to keep me accountable, and I dove deep into the alcohol. And I started to experience what the old timers talk about, the amounts, you know, the amount that I was drinking, and it just got darker and darker and darker, and I just pulled in and pulled in and pulled in to where there was just nobody. I had pushed everybody out of my life. I just drank, you know, and I drank my business away. To the point where it was me and one hardcore helper, Jim. He's a little crystal meth addict. We worked well together because he had the energy. He had the energy that I didn't have. So he'd get everything set up in the morning. He'd do all the stuff. He'd get all ready and all that. And when I was drinking, that was just fine. I'd sit out and just be trying to drink a coffee, catch up, wait for the liquor store to open at 9. Once I got a drink in me, I could do a little work. But it kind of worked. When I got sober, he quit because he said he couldn't deal with me sober. But it just kind of went on, and it just kept getting deeper and deeper, and it got bizarre. The alcohol got so bizarre. I mean, I've told people about this, to where I had these fears and anxieties about, you know, I was boarded up. I had my windows like taped over, shit like a crackhead, you know what I mean? And if the phone rang, I jumped. If the doorbell rang, holy shit, I'm moving to another room, just quietly waiting for him to go away. I mean, just bizarre behavior. You know, go to bed at night with a knife in my hand, because I think there's somebody in the basement, but I'm not going to go down there to check. I'm just going to sit here and wait for them like an alligator. I figure I'll get them when I get close enough. Just bizarre, but it took me to weird places. And the amounts, the sickness, you know, towards the end. And when I say the end, there was actually a couple ends, because there was a few periods of dry runs before this period of sobriety. But before that, there was a six-month period and a nine-month period, and then I finally got it this time. But, you know, it just, I was bleeding. I probably had a bleeding ulcer. I mean, there was, you know, throwing up blood and blood coming out everywhere. And I knew I was sick, and I was feeling it. I was drinking, you know, I was chasing vodka with Pepto-Bismol, and it was a mess, and I hurt so bad. You know, the physical pain was so intense, my stomach or whatever, but I just drank past it. Lucky I didn't kill myself. You know, Karen, after talking to Karen, and she told me about Pepto-Bismol and aspirin, I guess, it's toxic. When you're doing a bottle a day, you can't do that. Inevitably, so the bleeding and all that was just exacerbated by all the, you know, probably what I was trying to cure it with. But just really experienced the maintenance type alcoholism, and then the withdrawal from alcoholism, which probably wasn't as bad as their narcotic withdrawal, but it's pretty damn rough in itself. And I tried to get sober many times, but I couldn't get past the third day. The shakiness, the God, it was just, you know, and so I reached that point, and I think that's where I needed to reach. You know, I'd always experienced alcohol, the consequences from alcohol, because I'm a belligerent alcoholic, but I'd never experienced that addiction to it, the physical addiction to it, and that's what took me down, was just that level of addiction where I had to drink around the clock pretty much, and the amounts just kept increasing, and I just kept feeling sicker and sicker, you know. So these couple other attempts I tried, but again, the defiance came back, you know. I just would not, I wouldn't surrender to this thing. I wouldn't get a sponsor because I'm not answering to any frickin' buddy. I'll come and listen to you people. That's what I'm willing to do. I'll come and hang out. And the other thing is every time I got sober, I had two goals, get back financially and hook up. So I was chasing women all over meetings. I knew which women went to which meetings and which I had potential and which didn't, you know what I mean? And I found the greatest potential in AA is the women under 90 days. They're much easier than the women with 5 years. So that was my target, and I got what I sought, two sick people. And one thing I want to tell, I'm going to put this in out there, because if you're sponsoring a woman and you tell her to stay away from a specific guy, you are all but telling her or making her go to that guy. Because every woman I'd hook up with, my sponsor said to stay away from you. And they were drawn to that. You know, it must be something. Yeah, that's just, so it wasn't helping by these women sponsors telling their females to stay away from me at the time. Anyway, you know, a few of these times didn't really face consequence other than, and I don't know how long I stayed out after those 6 month and 9 month period, but when I came in this time, and it just, God, I was just so beaten up, you know, and can't believe I wasted all that time in the store. 7 years I thought it would change, but anyway, when I came in this time, I just was whooped, you know, and I came in and it was Debbie sitting about where Tracy is right there, and I was sitting like where Charlie. And she shared, and I don't know, something about the way she shared or the way she presented this thing made sense to me finally. You know, I looked at my whole experience, 26 years of being in and out of AA, and it was like, you know, I had never given this program a chance. I had never given sobriety a chance. I'd never given the steps a chance to work. How could I say this didn't work, you know, if I'd never really tried it? And I made a decision to try it, to do it, just to do what was told to me to do, which meant getting a sponsor, which, you know, I prayed about that one, and this guy kept popping up in my head. His name was Bill, and Bill was a gung-ho AA, super involved, like a super AA, you know what I mean? He's just like an AA cheerleader. And I was like, this guy's way too excited about this shit. I mean, what? I liked Bill as a person, but I thought he took this a little too serious. You know what I mean? But he kept coming. He was there, and I asked him. It turns out me and Bill were almost identical in personality and mental illness as well. So I ended up working with him, and it was the first time I had trusted somebody enough to really get to what's going on with me. I remember the first time I told him, I was going through this paranoid, delusional thing, conspiracy, people were plotting, and I knew it was nuts. I was sober enough to know this isn't real, you know what I mean? You're just making this shit up in your head. But I couldn't stop obsessing about it. And it was so I called Bill, and he said, what's going on? And I said, oh, freaking, I'm just nuts, man, you know? And he said, well, what's going on? I was like, it's just crazy. He said, well, tell me specifically what you're thinking. You know, so I told him specifically, and he starts laughing and says, yeah, you're fucking nuts, you know what I mean? But then he gave me an example of a situation where he had built up this whole plot and scenario, whatever. And that did so much for me. It made me realize at least I'm not the only freaking one, you know what I mean? Other people are crazy too, and I've come to realize that most of you all are just like me. I'm not unique, and you know, that was a big burden lifted. And then, you know, progressing through the steps, fourth step is something that I'd worked 1, 2, 3. I don't even know. You can't say I'd worked it because I'd never done a fourth step. I think you can tell somebody's worked a step three when they're doing their step four. That's how you tell somebody's. That's part of it. When I finally did that, that was the big breakthrough. When I took that fourth and fifth step, and honestly, you know, uncomfortably honest. That's how I got. I put it all down and I shared it. I saw the picture. I saw the patterns. I saw the problem. I saw me. And, you know, it gave me some understanding and some insight. And after that fifth step, I took it and I was just proud of myself. I was just like patting myself on the back. You finally did it. You know what I mean? And then so I didn't experience much. We were all here at the picnic table. But on my way home, it hit me. And emotion like I'd never felt in my life. I can't even describe the emotion. It was so much. It was like everything I hadn't cried about for my entire life that I should have Boom, it came out. So, you know, I'm driving down traffic, barely able to drive. And I got home and I got on my knees for that. Always gets me. I cannot tell the story without crying. So I don't tell it very often. But when I hit my knees and I took that seven-step prayer, and then I was quiet. Some people say, you know, if you hear anybody say they heard God's voice, then you should probably run. But I'm telling you, at that moment, it wasn't me. And the voice was, you never have to live like that again. And first time after that was the first time I felt safe, protected. You know, like God was looking out for me. So in the, you know, in sobriety, so I was on fire there for a minute. I mean, a couple years, people were like, nobody with 2 years can be this freaking happy, because I was just, I was so filled, I was so grateful, I was just so amazed at the difference between being sober and being dry. You know what I mean? Just how powerful this thing can be, how much peace we get, we can experience if we're willing to do these things. And getting to be a part of this group, the Breakfast Club, and getting to know people and watching other people recover. I mean, it was just incredible. But at a period, I got 4 minutes. At a period, I drifted away. You know, I got away and I got again obsessed with the financial side. And I got back into, you know, I went through a period where I really cut back on meetings. I was working two jobs. And it never fails. When I go that route of thinking that I got to do this, I got to do that, and I'm trying to generate finances, my bank account just, there's nothing there. When I let go and I serve God and I work 20 hours a week, it's five times as big. I don't understand how it works, but it works. The book says that financial will follow spiritual well-being. And so anyway, I got myself really away. I hadn't been to a meeting in a couple of weeks. I'm working two jobs. I had gotten involved in stocks, and my stocks were down from initial investment, about $8,000, was down to like $2,000, and that was killing me. And it ended up coming way back, but that's a whole other story. But and all of a sudden, the thought of a drink just came, and it came fast out of nowhere. I can't say it came out of nowhere because I knew I was uncomfortable. I might have had some passing thoughts, but when it hit at 5.5 years sobriety, it felt like I had been drinking still. It was a body craving. It was a physical craving. It was like the only thing that was going to relieve what I was feeling was a drink. And I'm trying to, on the way to the liquor store, I'm telling myself, you're going to lose Karen. You're going to lose everything. You're going to go back to jail. You're going to lose your kids. You're going to lose this. You're going to lose that. Call your sponsor. I couldn't stop it. I could not freaking stop myself from going. And I made it to the liquor store. And the only thing I did is I asked God. I said, God, you have got to stop me. And again, you know, he did. And that was a huge, huge thing in sobriety. And since then, let me tell you something. I do not skip meetings. I do not not stay connected here because I don't want to drink. I don't want to go back to that life. I just do not want to suffer like that again. And I absolutely know that it's only by the grace of God. There's nothing else. I'm an idiot. I will screw anything up. I don't have the capacity to do this without God's help and without your help. But with God's help and with your help, I got a shot, you know. There's things in my life today that I want to change. There's personality defects that keep me from doing some of the things that I want to do. But I believe that if I trust God and just keep trying, He'll open the doors, He'll do what needs to be done. I've gotten that faith slowly over time by experience. Every time when I first came in, I was just willing to get on my knees and pray to who I didn't know. I took the action and it worked, and as I've took it over and over again in my sobriety, I'm convinced, I know there's a God, and I know that's my source. And as long as I remember that, as long as I come back to that, then I'm okay. So I talk slightly longer than I do in the average meeting, and you know. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait. Because I skip this a lot of times and talking about my sobriety, because Karen is a huge, huge part of this. She's going to tell her story next week, so I got to give her a good plug so she gives me one. But when I came in this time, and I'll try to be brief here, but when I came in this last time, my sponsor did not tell me I couldn't have a relationship or anything like that. He said, listen, I would rather you just communicate with me than hide from me doing something I'm telling you not to do. He said, you're a grown-ass man. If you want to hook up with a woman, that's your problem. There's danger there. But the most important thing is I want us to stay communicating so that you don't feel like you have to hide from me. I think that's a beautiful way to sponsor. Don't tell me what to do. You know, and so I did, and I hooked up with women, and some of the black book came out, because when I get sober, when I'm drinking, I don't need a woman. I got my alcohol. But when I got sober, it became a little different. You know what I mean? I'm alive again. I'm awake again. And so I did at first, you know, but what I found was those relationships just did not appeal to me anymore. The superficiality of a sex-based relationship just didn't hold like it used to when I was younger, you know, and the meaningless of it and whatever, and I longed for something more. And when I did my fourth step and I set that ideal, I said I wouldn't hook up with somebody, I wouldn't have sex with me until I felt it was somebody that I could have a long-term relationship if not married, you know what I mean? Period. Well, then shortly after that, I hooked up with a girl at the gym, and it was Natalie. When we were out to eat, she goes, oh, how does that work with your ideal? And damn. So I let that one go, and I spent some time alone. And, you know, Karen and I had been sitting out at the picnic table talking and you know, developed a friendship. And then there was the great reveal, which some of you might remember, where she had come in pretty overweight, and she used to wear this huge sweater hiding herself. Well, she had lost a bunch of weight, and she took off her sweater one day, and she's looking toned and tanned, and like, wow, it was the first time I've seen her. And anyway, we made a connection, and I tell you, our relationship has been incredible. We are equally yoked in the sense that we both have strong faith, and I think that's what has survived our. It's why she's put up with me, maybe that and my sense of humor, I think. But our relationship's been incredible. The things we have been through, the things that God's done for us. I mean, so many times from starting off in a little 400 square foot efficiency apartment with one window this big, dark, gloomy, bug infested, $300 a month, and we could barely make that. You know what I mean? To living in a house today has been a process, and there's just been such miracles along the way. When we went to another lady's house in the program, we had got an offer to move into another house, but didn't have any money saved up. So I'm working a job in a basement, and the lady gives me a $3,500 bonus. For, you know, the basement was probably a $30,000 job. She gave me a 10%. Never have I gotten a bonus, like never. That money went to pay for our place. Stuff like that has happened over and over again. We've been watched her go through the process. I'll let her tell it next month, but it has been an incredible relationship. And I'm so grateful for my kids have a mother, because remember, they don't have one right now. So Karen is the mother that they don't, you know, without her, they wouldn't know that female, the tenderness and the nurturing that only a woman can give, I think. So I'm grateful for that, but I love you guys, and that's it. Appreciate it.